Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
This podcast exists because of the paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. I just want to give a shout out to all the paid subscribers. Thanks for supporting A Cast of Kings this season. We really appreciate it, and we've enjoyed following along the show and comparing the book Fire and Blood to House of the Dragon. Thanks to everyone who makes this podcast possible.
Each of you has left behind a life to answer this call. A life to which you might never return. If you survive, you will be transformed. No man or woman can face a dragon and be otherwise.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast about House of the Dragon. I am David Chen, and I really have serious concerns about the occupational safety conditions in Westeros. Joining me today, she is the author of The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones, Kim Renfro.
On that note, I think it's important to use my platform here to say that you should never cross a picket line, especially if it's, you know, dragon keepers who are going on strike, because clearly bad things happen. So true.
Welcome to A Cast of Kings, folks. Jesse Earle is not with us today because she is doing stuff over at San Diego Comic-Con. Man, I am so jealous because some really major announcements went down this week at San Diego Comic-Con, and I wish I was in that room because it looks like it was electric. But anyway, we expect to have Jesse Earle back with us for the finale next week. Before I talk about the plan for next week, though, just a couple quick notes. So you can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Many of you do each week. And find us on TikTok at A Cast of Kings. We're also posting our videos on YouTube and on Instagram under the Decoding TV channels. So find us at Decoding TV on YouTube and Instagram. You want to watch the video version of these podcasts. So before we get to this week's episode of the show, I want to just discuss the plan for next week's episode. A little bit of behind the scenes for you folks. We have been getting screeners in advance. I hope people are marveling at how detailed these conversations are, like, and how we release them very soon after the show comes out. And that is because we've gotten screeners early all season. So huge thanks to HBO for that. But we did get a note this week saying, hey, you will not be getting the finale screener at all. So we will all be enjoying the finale together at the same time. Our current plan for Cast of Kings is to record our finale episode the night of. So it might release a little bit later than people are used to. But just letting you know, like, if there's a little bit of delay for the finale review episode, that's why. There's probably going to be no regular bonus episode at decodingtv.com for that episode, but there will be a subsequent episode that is released the following week where we kind of just look back at the season and pick up some threads that we didn't get to during our finale conversation. And that's because, like, when we record our finale episode, we're going to be reacting to it, like, really quickly, and it'll be raw, and we'll probably miss a bunch of stuff. So we'll have another episode the following week, I think the week of the 12th, to just kind of sum up anything we didn't get to. And of course, we'd love to have your questions and emails for that. So get them ready and send them to us at acastofkings thefrequencyshow@gmail.com. And we will address those again during the episode we release after the finale is out. So that's the plan for next week. No screeners for us. And so therefore the episode will come out later. And we'd love your comments and questions at acastofkings@gmail.com. All right. Kim Renfro, we are here to discuss House of the Dragon Season 2, Episode 7. Again, we don't know what the title of the episode is. I don't know why they're not releasing these things early, but we don't know what the title of the episode is. Last week, we had a bunch of guesses for what that title would be.
Mm-hmm.
Some really good ones, in my opinion. I think Jesse's LGBBQ is probably the best one.
Yeah, or Fire Island.
Fire Island. the actual title of last week's episode, Small Folk, which is really boring, I have to say. Not a great title. I'm not loving the titles this season, Kim Renfro. What do you think?
They started kind of strong.
Yeah, they started strong, and then...
And then they've become very, like, just very straightforward and simple, especially in a way where I'm like, I don't know why these aren't being announced ahead of time.
That is the most mind-blowing thing, is that they're not, like, spoilery in any way. You know, so it's just, I don't know what's going on over there at HBO, but they're, the last couple of episodes have had single word titles.
Right, just Regent.
Regent and Small Folk, and it's just like, okay, yeah. Evocative, not informative, really, even just I don't know what's going on. So all that said, we don't know what the title of season 2, episode 7 is. Kim Renfro, what's your guess for what this week's title will be?
I feel like reviving my guess from last week, because I feel like I jumped the gun on my guess being oriented around like dragon seeds, or like the fact that what's referred to as the red sowing taking place, because last week, you know, we saw Stefan Darklyn attempt to claim Sea Smoke and fail. This week, obviously, as we will talk about, there's a lot more people that lose their lives to the attempt of dragon riding, and so maybe they're gonna go with something more like dragon seeds, seed of the dragon, the red sowing this episode. Or if we're sticking to like the, you know, one word kind of like straightforward thing, maybe they're just gonna call it like bastards or riders or something like really to the point like that. So
yeah,
that's my best guess. What about you?
Love that, Kim. No additional work required for you. You're just reusing
copy-paste
the guesses from last week. That's cool. I think it's clearly going to be How to Train Your Dragons. This one is going to be, right? No reason for it not to be.
Mm-mm.
Other than that they're extremely uncreative over there at the title writing factory. Also, I had a kind of a half-baked idea. Three dragons outside Dragonstone, Missouri. That was kind of another one. Instead of three billboards, but that one. Is it Dragonstone, Westeros? Is that what that would be?
Yeah.
Is there like a region that Dragonstone isn't? Anyway.
No. Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, you just heard like six titles that will be better than whatever they come out with. So hire us, HBO.
Yeah.
Hire us.
I'm available for consults.
Okay. Before we get to a conversation about this week's episode, wanted to mention also some emails. We got a bunch of emails at acastofkings@gmail.com. This email comes in from Susan from St. Paul. And just wanted to mention it before we get started. A thought about Missaria and Rhaenyra's kiss. You all talked about the power dynamic in it from the perspective of the queen. Consider, though, while I do believe that the two have genuine affection for each other, Missaria is a former sex worker and a very smart woman who is a survivor. She learned at an early age to use people to her advantage with her body and her smarts. How do we know that the story about her father is true? Might it have been a ploy to gain Rhaenyra's sympathies to draw her closer? Was she really that innocent in the embrace and in the kiss? In short, I just wouldn't paint this scene as one-sided and Missaria as some victim. On face value, the scene seemed very consensual. From one standpoint, yes, the queen holds power over her, but that view alone lessens the value for Missaria's own power and intentions. When they talk of the two women as equals, I think that relates to them as powerful women who have given and assert that power in different ways. They are drawn to each other. Also, just because they kiss and may have sex, that also doesn't mean they'll have a relationship. That, too, is a power dynamic between them. Heat, attraction, respect, shared power. It doesn't have to mean a relationship. Thanks, as always, Susan from St. Paul, end quote. Huh? Anyway, just thought that was some a good commentary on like you know, reacting to the Missaria Rhaenyra stuff from last week.
Yeah, and the possibility of like what everyone's motivations and like the impact of this dynamic will be going forward for sure.
She is no sweet summer child. She is not a hothouse flower.
She's no Kristen Cole.
Where is that guy, by the way? We haven't seen that guy in a while. So anyway. All right. Thanks for all.
I'm not complaining. hadn't missed him.
Thanks for all the emails. Keep them coming into acastofkings@gmail.com. All right, Kim. Let's talk about House of the Dragon, Season 2, Episode 7. What were your overall thoughts on this episode?
Another great one, in my opinion. Another really cool mix, I think, of the show adapting some of the book events from Fire and Blood in ways that I didn't necessarily expect or that were just really satisfying to watch unfold. Particularly, I think, like, the entire sequence in the Weirwood Grove at Harrenhal. Like, after so much of Harrenhal's events this season, I think, feeling kind of divisive, like, as that scene was unfolding, I was like, oh, this, I feel like this is, like, a universal, like, this is some good stuff right here from the world of Westeros. And then on top of it, just so much, like, the dragon content, for lack of a better word, is just, like, building on itself so well this season. And I thought it was so cool to see the dragons in so many different arenas, like in broad daylight out on the beach, flying around King's Landing, inside, like deep inside the caverns, like just really good stuff this week. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. What about you?
This was a great episode of television. I mean, here's how you know the episode was great. Even the Harrenhal stuff was good. Even the Harrenhal stuff, which I've been complaining about all season, was good this episode. So it's like, oh, wow, they delivered on the Harrenhal. So then it's like, okay, I'm already the episode's earned a lot of credit. And then an action-packed kind of finale sequence. I have some qualms with, like, how Rhaenyra handled that whole situation, which we can discuss.
Sure. Yeah.
But otherwise, I think it's just really, really well done. Like, just top-notch technical execution overall. So, like, just a really strong episode that I quite enjoyed. My one concern is that I have some bad vibes or bad feeling about the next episode. Like, the next episode is supposed to be the season finale, and I just don't know how they're going to tie anything up in any kind of satisfying fashion. Like, I have a feeling one of two things is going to happen next episode is... Either they're going to rush through a bunch of stuff and it's not going to feel very good, or it's just going to feel like we just kind of arbitrarily stopped following these storylines at this point in time. Now, maybe they'll prove me wrong and they'll deliver a finale that's like, oh, wow, that was extremely satisfying. And I feel like that was a great ending for the season. But, like, based on everything that's been set up with Sheepstealer and the Three Dragons and Daemon and Harrenhal, I just have no idea how they're going to be able to tie all this up in like 60 to 90 minutes in a way that makes me feel like, oh, wow, the season feels done and complete. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's not, it hasn't been building towards a very clear, like, conflict climax.
Exactly.
It's been a bunch of little things building upon each other, which is kind of what season one was. But season one, I think, was very clearly building towards the death of Viserys and the ascension,
the aftermath.
Like the aftermath. Whereas right here, it is definitely less clear, even to me as a book reader, what they're going to choose to land on as sort of like the
they literally could have ended this season, literally could have ended with this episode. Like, that ending was a really strong ending for this episode. So, like, I'm like, oh, wow, great ending. And I'm like, but what is
now
next?
What?
Like, how is the next episode going to bring closure to any of this? You know, I don't know. I'm very skeptical.
Also, maybe worth noting that season one was 10 episodes. And for whatever reason, this season is only 8. And it's like, why do that? What was, you know, what was the thinking of, like, breaking up the events and the arc leading towards a finale? Yeah, I'll be curious to see how they try and land the ship here.
Yeah. But otherwise, great episode of television, great episode House of the Dragon. Had a blast watching this one. Let's take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more conversation about this episode of House of the Dragon right after this. This episode of A Cast of Kings is sponsored by BetterHelp. Folks, if you have been watching House of the Dragon this season, you know that comparison is the thief of joy. We got characters like Aemon comparing his situation to Aegon, wanting to take his place. And where does that lead? Nowhere good. Nowhere good. And, you know, that's a lesson we can take in our lives as well, because when you look on your social medias, it might look like everyone has it all together on their Instagrams or their Facebooks or their TikToks, but in reality, they probably don't. Well, therapy can help you focus on what you want instead of what others have, so you can start living your best life. I personally use therapy and find it to be very valuable in figuring out what my goals should be and focusing on myself instead of comparing myself to everyone around me, figuring out what I want to accomplish and what feelings I have about specific things that are happening around me. If you are thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Stop comparing and start focusing with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/castofkings today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/castofkings. Thanks to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. All right, let's get into what actually happens, Kim Renfro. Oh, actually, before we get to what happens, the opening credits. There was a change to the opening credits sequence, right, Kim?
Yeah, nothing added this time, but this was the first time that I noticed that they've removed something, which is the little embroidery vignette of Alicent arriving to the wedding welcome feast in her green dress, which was like kind of like a big marker. This was back, like, you know, young Alicent and young Rhaenyra. And they used to have that as part of the buildup to showing Aegon and Rhaenyra being crowned. And they seem to have dropped that little one, which I guess makes sense, because if they're going to keep adding things, they can't just have like the credits eventually be, you know, 6 minutes long or whatever. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting that they've started to drop things in addition to adding them.
Right. Because like, what was the approach if they're going to keep adding things? Is like, well, they could just speed everything up or like make shorter edits of everything. But it seems like they're definitely going to be dropping things and adding new things as time goes on. And that's perfectly fine. So anyway, the penultimate episode of House of Dragon begins right where the last week's installment ended, with Rhaenyra confronting Sea Smoke's new rider. She and Adam of Hull face each other on the shore, their dragons each standing behind them. Adam quickly bends the knee to his queen and tells her he only wants to serve her and learn the art of dragon riding. So, first of all, incredible visual of the two actors standing on the beach. Obviously, the dragons weren't there, but it really does feel like they went to a beach to shoot this. And obviously, they would have to plan it out so that when they're shooting it and composing it, they have, you know, the dragons are going to go here. And it's a super striking visual. I also thought about how last episode, I think, ended with them hearing that somebody's riding Sea Smoke, right? Mm-hmm. And Rhaenyra says, I need to go find out what's going on there. And so she escapes and goes to find. And so I'm very curious if they like shot any of that stuff, because, you know, of them like pursuing each other and then landing or whatever. But whatever the case, at some point they looked at all that, either on the script or as an idea or on screen, and they said, it's going to be just way more impactful if we just cut to them on the beach facing each other. And I think they made the right choice. Kim Renfro, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I thought of was like, oh, they didn't want to deal with the logistics of having a person hop off their dragon back again. Right, yeah. Like, that was always a thing, even throughout Game of Thrones.
It always looks a little awkward, right?
It's a little awkward and, like, obviously takes a lot more CGI to make that look like believable. I can assume that like either Rhaenyra sort of like chased him down, like, you know, kind of like a cop pulling a car over being like, land your dragon, we need to talk. Or maybe like Adam and Sea Smoke were already on the ground and she just like, you know, spotted them and landed there to confront him. So yeah,
this is the advantage of just starting with them on the beach, is you don't need to deal with any of that stuff.
Exactly.
You don't need to deal with any of that. Just like, hey, they're on the beach, they got there somehow, we're good to go.
So. Yeah. And I love how like the it's almost like we hear the dragons talking to each other before either Rhaenyra or Adam speak. Like, there was so much great, symmetry between the way that each rider and their dragon were behaving and, like, the body language. And when Rhaenyra walks forward, Syrax kind of starts to follow her, and just really cool, an additional insight, I think, to the way that a dragon and their rider have a bond and both, like, communicate to other dragons on behalf of their rider or vice versa, like, that they follow their rider's wishes or instincts when in a sort of confrontation like this.
Yeah. So Adam tries to explain what the situation is. It's a really weird one, you know, that he... Like, Sea Smoke came to him. He didn't do anything.
I got bullied into this.
Yeah, yeah.
by a dragon.
Yeah. And quickly announces allegiance for Rhaenyra. And Rhaenyra is skeptical, I think. I think she sees this as, like, is this some kind of ploy, right? Is this some kind of ruse to ensnare me and get me into trouble? But I think she eventually becomes convinced. Mm-hmm. There is a quick note where they exchange, or she asks, like, who his parents are, right? Because obviously, like, only people who are Targaryens or Velaryons are able to ride dragons. Is that right?
Not even Velaryons, like, historically.
Okay.
So the reason why Laenor, who is Adam's half-brother, the understood reason why he was a dragon rider wasn't because he was Velaryon through Corlys, but because his mother was Rhaenys Targaryen.
I see.
So it is a, like, this is a new thing within both, like, book readers' understanding of how dragon riding and dragon bonding works, in addition to, like, Rhaenyra being like, wait a second, like, who are you? I thought only Targaryens, people who had Targaryen blood specifically, could be dragon riders. And so, yeah. I
see. So what is the new thing, then?
The new thing with Adam is, well, so... They allude to it, which is that we don't know who his mother is. So, like, now it could be explained away by saying that, like, his mother was the one who had Targaryen blood. And Corlys kind of alludes to that later in the episode. But it's also new that, like, we don't know what has happened to Laenor. Like, it's unusual that a dragon would have two bonded riders at any given time.
I see.
And in the show, last we saw, Laenor was alive. So...
Right.
And that, I think that adds to what is going on with Rhaenyra in this scene as well, because, like, there's a chance that she heard, oh, Sea Smoke has been seen with someone riding him. And she might have thought, oh, did Laenor come back? Like, one else knows that he's alive, presumably, besides her and Daemon.
Yeah.
But then she lands on the beach and it's like, wait a second, you're not Laenor. And, like, who the hell are you? And she still doesn't understand that Adam is Laenor's half-brother. So, like, that might be that. I think that's like the most logical reason why Sea Smoke, like, literally sniffed him out and chased him down. But
yeah,
unclear.
Interesting. So the new component is A, that a dragon can have more than one bonded rider. That's a big thing, right?
Assuming that's that Laenor's still alive.
Right. And then the second thing is potentially non-Targaryens are able to ride dragons, right?
Yeah.
Like, now, we don't know for sure.
Right.
But yeah. Either way, though, Adam does not confess that Corlys is his father.
Right.
In this, I like the part about, like, my people don't really have annals.
Right.
Which I thought was not everyone has a 23andMe in Westeros. Basically,
yeah.
Right.
But it's also interesting. Like, he doesn't say I don't know who my father was. He, like, straight up lies and says, like, my father is of no consequence. And it's like, well, that's gonna be quickly.
Well,
could
I think
quickly disproven.
I think he just doesn't want to get his dad into trouble.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think if everyone knows that he's Corlys's kid, like, it could create a scandal, you know, and he doesn't want that. So it's just, there's no advantage to letting people know about it.
Yeah.
Other than it might help them to find more dragon riders.
Yeah.
So anyway, a lot more happens with Rhaenyra and the dragons this episode. But before we get to that, let's recap the other important storylines, starting for a change with Harrenhal. Now that the former Lord Tully has died, young Oscar Tully is in charge of the Riverlands. He arrives to Harrenhal at Daemon's request, along with all the other Riverlords, and the young lord immediately asserts his authority with Daemon, agreeing to honor the oath to King Viserys and back Queen Rhaenyra, but refusing to capitulate to Daemon's bullying. He insists that Daemon carry out punishment for Lord Blackwood's war crimes, though they were done at the King Consort's request. Daemon seemingly beheads Willem Blackwood before having another vision of King Viserys in his bedroom. And in that vision, King Viserys is talking about the crown, and he says, you know, you always wanted it, Daemon, but it crushes whoever wears it. Do you want it still? Heavy is the head that wears the crown. So anyway, that's the Daemon Harrenhal storyline this episode. This is great. The storyline roared to life this week because you actually have somebody who can go toe-to-toe with Daemon, and also it's a kid.
Yeah.
And that's what's great about it is like, oh, wow. Like you expect it to be some big, burly guy that, you know, but it's just like, this is a kid. And he is putting Daemon to the test. I love this whole sequence. Kim Renfro, any thoughts and observations?
Yeah, my initial notes that I was jotting down, I think I got 5 minutes into this sequence and just wrote, I love this kid. Like, I love him so much. I liked him when they introduced him in the earlier scene from this season, but at the time he wasn't Lord Paramount and he was a little bit more meek and seemed a little more uncertain of like exactly how to handle this conversation with Daemon. And I did not expect this level of like, as Daemon says, boldness from him. I think that the performance from the actor, his name's Archie Barnes. I like Googled him immediately because I was like, oh, like
he looks like an Archie Barnes. I have to say,
looks like an Archie Barnes. Also, he's 18. I think that he pulls off younger than 18. Like he seems to me like he could be, you know, like a 14-year-old or so, maybe. But yeah, it felt to me like I was watching like a stage play of George R. R. Martin level dialogue and like, you know, power struggles and the way that the lords of Westeros want to like adhere to custom, the way that they all perceive justice, the way that they sort of test the mettle of their new paramounts at any given time. I thought it was just so satisfying to watch and really believable in terms of like the lords sort of questioning Oscar's authority, Oscar admitting to Daemon like, hey, yeah, I'll back you, but this is about to be a tough, like, we're about to walk into a very tough conversation here. And like this, like everyone has to handle this like perfectly in order for us to all, you know, move forward together as a unit. And I thought that the way that that unfolded was just so satisfying to watch. And really, especially like you said, like to watch a kid be the one to be able to stand up to Daemon and really by doing so gain the respect of Daemon and all of his new vassals. So just a great work, great performances, great writing. I also loved that it was set in the Weirwood Grove because again, it felt very in tune with George R. R. Martin's universe. And if you remember from Game of Thrones, Weirwood's like the faces that are carved into the trees.
Yeah.
That is like basically the mechanism by which a green seer like Bran Stark becomes, can basically like see into the past and observe things that happened. And I feel like this was a scene that you could so easily imagine like being a very consequential moment in this war and like a green seer like looking back and seeing like, oh, this is exactly how, you know, the new Lord Paramount of the Riverlands, you know, dealt with Daemon in this moment. What did Daemon do when he was like put to this test of like needing to execute the man who had been most loyal to him up to this point? Just really great. Just, yeah, I just thought it was awesome.
My favorite part of the scene is when I think Oscar Tully calls Daemon the prince. And Daemon corrects him and says like, actually king or king consort, right? Like, and then Oscar Tully just walks right up to him and says, do you want my army or not? Like, basically you better shut up or else like, this is not going to go like,
yeah,
you misunderstand the balance of power in this situation. And
And like it reminded me of the scene from season one where, when Daemon, because Daemon at some point says to Oscar Tully, like, mind your tongue, boy. And it reminded me of the scene in season one when Vaemond Velaryon was accusing Rhaenyra's children of being bastards very publicly. And in that case, when he was told to mind his tongue and didn't, like, the next thing Damon did was cut his head off. And, you know, he didn't care in that moment about risking the alliance with House Velaryon or doing anything. He was much more in the vein of, like, I need to assert my power over this person, and, like, I'm just gonna cut his head off and not worry about the consequences. And this was a moment where you could see that Damon was like, all right, now's not the time for, like, brash beheading of children. I actually, like, I need to listen to this kid, because he's right that, like, I need his armies. And if that means, you know, letting him call me prince or letting him maybe undermine me a tiny bit, so be it. Because I think Damon is growing, which is what we all hoped would be the result, I think, of all of this.
I don't know if that's how I'd describe what's happening. I mean, Oscar Tully pulls this massive power move.
Yeah.
Which is all, because you're watching the scene and things are not settled, right? Things are very tense.
Yeah.
And as with all things Game of Thrones, you just know that it's not going to come to a satisfying, peaceful conclusion. And so when Oscar Tully seems to have the upper hand, he then says, hey, by the way, you need to execute this guy who was extremely loyal to you. It's like this big power move that he pulls. And it's not just about asserting his own power, but it's about damaging Damon psychologically, subjugating Damon psychologically as well, which I think is just like, wow, didn't know the kid had it in him. But anyway.
Yeah. I feel like it was like a test of, like,
yeah,
will Damon do the quote unquote right thing in order to like actually get all of these lords to serve in his army.
Right.
As opposed to, like, yeah, like bullying them into it, of being like, when Damon's like, I don't need their love, I just need their swords. And it's like, well, they're not going to necessarily, like, love him for having executed Willem Blackwood, but I think that maybe they will be like,
they'll respect him at least.
Yeah. Well, like, you're like, right. Like, you're willing to listen.
Yeah. In the notes, Kim, you wrote, Damon seemingly beheads Willem Blackwood, because we don't actually see him cut his head off, right, in the show?
Right. And, like, the fact that it cuts immediately to a vision, it's like we seem to... I think it's safe to assume that he did.
Yeah, are you aware of Willem Blackwood's fate in the book? Like, do you know what happens there, or...?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess I would say there's probably like a 90% chance he's dead, right?
Yeah.
As a show watcher, there's a 90% chance he's dead.
Yeah.
But hey, the show might say, hey, we're going to do something different there. So
I just thought it was interesting that we don't see it happen. And I'm like, what? Yeah. The fact that Damon immediately flashes into this vision again, like we were talking last week about how the cuts between his, like, sort of like waking and dreaming state usually, like, mirror physically where he is at any given time. And I was like, oh, interesting that we cut, like, straight from him, like, being in the Godswood and being, like, very present to being dreaming and walking.
Yeah, it'd be one thing if the show would, like, shied away from showing us that kind of brutality, but it never does. Yeah. So it's weird to not show a death unless, you know, that person's still alive somehow. So we'll see. We'll probably learn the fate of Willem Blackwood next week. Anyway. Meanwhile, in King's Landing, Alicent and Aegon are struggling in very different ways. Alicent decides to escape to the nearby forest with only a Kingsguard for company. She rides her horse and swims in a lake while contemplating how she's been cast aside. So this is Alicent's walkabout episode. You know, we talked last week about how she has one son, Daeron, and I saw a lot of people pointing out that seems to be the only kid that did well, like, is doing okay, and it's also the only son of hers that wasn't raised by her, you know? And I think there's a lot of self-reflection going on of, oh, you know, are we the baddies? Am I the person who's raising the children badly because, you know, is it because of me that they're doing badly? Mm-hmm. But yeah, just a lot of scenes of her out in nature. I feel bad for the Kingsguard guy because if something bad happens, you know, his head's going to roll, so... she's putting her in a really challenging situation, putting him in a really challenging situation. Any thoughts on the Alicent stuff this episode, Kim?
I thought that her scenes were all just very, like, beautiful and, like, I think that there's definitely some symbolism there of like her desire for like cleansing of her soul or spirit, almost in like this like religious way. She's of all the characters, she's the one who has shown the most devotion to the faith of the Seven, and you know, she spends time in the Sept, she prays individually. Back when Jaehaerys was first killed, like, she expressed almost feeling like it was the gods punishing her because of like the sins of her family. And, you know, we saw earlier in the season her sort of like scrubbing herself in the bathtub extra hard in a way mm-hmm. that sort of felt to me like almost like an anxiousness, or like, you know, a nice metaphor for trying to like self-clean. And yeah, the fact that she says, you know, nothing is clean here, and we see the rats who have returned. I mean, all the rat catchers are dead. So yeah, the rats yeah. have returned to the keep. And yeah, just that imagery.
You know how much I love that rat symbolism.
So I'm glad that they brought them back for you. Which is funny too, because in the books it says that the solution after all the rat catchers are killed is that Otto Hightower brings 100 cats into the Red Keep yes, to manage yeah. the system. And I'm like, I actually would have really loved to, like, instead of seeing rats now, to just see a bunch of cats like randomly. Kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah,
like,
that might still happen. We don't know. That might still happen. And that's how might we got Sir Pounce, right?
Yeah. Assuming that he was a descendant of those cats. So yeah, I think, you know, good scenes for Alicent here, continuing her sort of self-reflection. I am very curious as to, speaking of, you know, what note they're going to end season one on. I'm sort of like, oh, like Alicent really does seem very unmoored right now. Yeah. And I'm yeah. kind of wondering how she's going to be tied back into the fold of all of these characters, like what avenue they're going to use.
Yeah.
To bring
absolutely.
Her in.
In the Red Keep's courtyard, Larys and Ironrod watch as two of Aegon's friends turned Kingsguard are stripped of their cloaks and sent to the wall. This was a little confusing to me, Kim. Like, mm-hmm. were these guys like Aegon's friends?
Yeah.
And like, why were they being sent to the wall? Like, what was going on here? You know, can you help explain this?
It's interesting. I also was kind of like, huh, like, what was their punishment? And at some point, Lord Jasper Ironrod says, like, well, they did start the riot. And I was like, huh, like, was someone not told about the food ships? Like, has that somehow completely gone under the radar as the reason for why the small folk sort of started rioting last episode? And then I was like, okay, maybe one of them was the one who cut off the arm of that guy when he grabbed at Alicent, and like maybe they're viewing that as having not only been going against the Dowager Queen's wishes, because she had, you know, she had said like no, and like sheath your swords, etc. Like, so maybe they're somehow taking the fall for that.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Either way, it seems to be a contrived reason for Aemond. Like, it seems like Aemond certainly has taken some contrived reason for sending away two of the Kingsguard who were most loyal to Aegon, is kind of what I'm reading into it. And
gotcha.
So they were just sent to the wall because presumably, like, the reason being that they, you know, they disgraced themselves as Kingsguard and are no longer worthy of the cloak. Oh, I also was wondering, maybe it was that another reason, which is maybe a more valid one that Aemond has, is that Aemond would have seen them. Aemond did see them in the brothel that time.
Right.
Know, before everything went down at
like
Rook's
kind
Rest.
Of mocking him while he
mocking
was,
him. And yeah. It is true that the Kingsguard vows include celibacy. And so maybe he was just taking this opportunity to be like, hey, I actually, like, before I was regent, I know for a fact that you guys broke your vow of celibacy in a brothel. And like, that's the reason that I'm using for stripping you of this title. So yeah, definitely interesting.
There's also this scene where Larys tells this other guy, Ironrod, mm-hmm. not to mention the sighting of sea smoke with a new rider to anyone. Specifically, he was going to tell Aemond about it.
Yeah.
Did you, like, I didn't really understand what was up with that. Did you grasp what was going on there?
I wasn't sure either. Really, throughout this episode, Larys just seems...
Yeah, Larys' actions are really mysterious.
Larys seems to be executing some plan of
his
that is a mystery to us, the show watchers. And that I assume we will get more clarity on at some point. But, like, yeah, that was again kind of a moment where I was like, huh, like what is Laris's reason for not wanting Aemond told about this? Like, both that I thought it was funny this is the first time that like we hear like just how shoddy of sources all of this information really is, you know, like Laris is like, oh, like how do you know that, and he's like, oh, I heard it from a stableman who heard it from a fisherman who heard it from a shipmate, and like Laris being like, huh, like those aren't my sources as Master of Whispers, mm-hmm. so like maybe he's just, you know, he doesn't want to pass on information that might not be true. Mm-hmm. But then there's an interesting look exchanged between them at the end of the episode when we hear the Dragon Rider coming. And Laris almost seems to be like smug about the fact that like now they're being taken unawares
mm-hmm.
by a dragon once again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not sure. But I'm not sure that we're supposed to know exactly what Laris' motivations are yet.
Well, Laris heads to Aegon's room where he finds Aegon in the middle of a painful physical therapy walk with Master Orwell. It's revealed that Laris has been pushing the Maester to do these exercises with Aegon, even though they wear him out and cause him pain. But Laris insists that Aegon won't be able to rest for a long time yet. Again, very cryptic,
mm-hmm.
enigmatic remark. Like, what plans does he have for Aegon? It's unclear. We do see like Aegon's new look. Which is really distinct. His like ear has been completely burned off. It's really
upsetting. Like a hole in the side of his head.
Yeah, he's got a hole in the side of his head. Yeah, you know. And but anyway.
Yeah, another moment where I was like, okay, I understand that sometimes physical therapy is like it's necessary to sort of endure a certain amount of pain and discomfort as you're trying to like heal. And do things, and that sometimes, you know, doctors or whatnot will kind of have to like push you. But the fact that the Maester was like, no, this is like too much too soon, and that Laris is insisting on it. Also the fact that like the Maester listens to Laris, I think, is an interesting like mm-hmm. order of hierarchy there.
Like Laris is in control, basically.
Right. And like, you know, the last we saw, Aegon was asking Laris for help. And so presumably what Laris is doing in this episode is in service of Aegon in some way, but it does not feel like it, right? Like it literally feels like he's pushing him past his physical limits right now for some purpose that is unclear to us.
Do you know the purpose as a book reader, or is this also a mystery to you?
They don't, like, this particular like dynamic of like Aegon privately asking for help and like this physical therapy stuff is not in the book.
Theory?
I have a theory as to where they're going with this. But
okay, we'll talk about it in bonus episode.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. And then there's also a quick scene of the Vale as Rhaena leaves the castle with little Aegon and Viserys. They're all supposed to be going to Pentos together, but when the gates close, Rhaena runs off the path and into the valley to try and find the wild dragon. This, I gotta say, this is a little silly, you know, to me. Like, they have this big caravan, and then Rhaena, pretty important person. This is basically like the Home Alone of Westeros, where they just leave this child behind. And they're like, oh. And then, like, I get what, you have made the guess on bonus episode that basically Rhaena is going to try to find this big mystery dragon that is in the Vale, like, and mm-hmm. that's going to become important somehow. But the way in which it's happening feels pretty clunky to me. Like, she's just literally running off and trying to find the dragon. Like, there's nothing artful about this, in my opinion.
And like the fact that like somehow she thinks no guards would be watching or like have noticed that like the party accompanying Aegon and Viserys somehow wouldn't care. I'm also
they could have done a thing where she like escapes in the middle of the night and goes but they put like no effort. She's just like, oh, we're in the caravan, and I literally run off in the middle of a big field, like where you can easily see you for miles.
It's just
like,
okay, there's no coverage.
All right, all right, whatever.
And the fact that it's like that, it's not like that. This is just like a single scene in this episode. Like, I was expecting to return to her at some point before the episode ended. Or I feel like they could have just saved that. Like, they could have paired this scene or like her leaving with her actually like finding the dragon or having some resolution to it, aside from having it be like this sort of random thread in this episode.
Pretty random. All right. Anyway, that's a bunch of a non-Dragonstone stuff that happens this episode. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more conversation about House of the Dragon right after this.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
All right, so back to Dragonstone for the remainder of our conversation. Rhaenyra returns to Dragonstone with Adam, but doesn't attend the small council meeting. Instead, she has a private conversation with Missaria about how the gods might have ordained Seasmoke's claiming of Adam. We also see Adam gets a new fancy room as a formal guest of the queen, and Corlys comes and talks to him. But Adam asks Corlys for leave as shipwright, and the Lord grants it, but doesn't acknowledge that he's Adam's father. All right, so like, I was a little confused. Essentially, there's three dragons, right? They have three dragons down there. There's Seasmoke, Vermithor, and who's the other one?
Silverwing.
So Adam has claimed Seasmoke, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And then so they still have two unassigned dragons. But the idea is that if they can get three dragons plus Rhaenyra's dragon plus Jace's dragon...
Mm-hmm.
Then they are going to have a formidable dragon force. That is their goal, right?
Yeah. Okay. And certainly the idea that multiple large, like that it would take more than one large dragon to attack Vhagar and potentially win, right? Yeah. Like Rhaenyra is like, I can't go after Vhagar just by myself on Syrax. So she wants some backup. And like, she also seems to have fully kind of, at least in this episode, she seems to have given up on the idea of Daemon raising an army for her. Like, she seems to really think that her only path forward is via dragon power and facing down Aemond and Vhagar in that way. So she's... Yeah. This episode, I think, is really interesting in the way that it... This is the first time that I'm like, oh, like, Rhaenyra, what are you doing here? Like, you're... Her motivations are starting to seem... a little bit more like fanatical and more like again, like her using words like ordained, and even like Adam's the one who brings it up first of being like, if the gods wish me to ride this dragon, why wouldn't I? And she seems to be like, oh, like, you know, I can't ask, you know, just my Kingsguard to go claim a dragon and have that work out. It's maybe I do have to sort of give way to higher powers here. But we see her dragon keepers, like, I think the fact that they quit in the face of this plan, and that they specifically, like she says, like the gods have brought all of these people here to try and ride a dragon, and they're like, no, they didn't, you did this.
Yeah.
But she seems to start like absolving herself of personal responsibility for the deaths that she's bringing about in this idea that like she's serving some sort of greater good.
I think she also mentions it to Jace too, like these are the options the gods have placed before me, or something along those lines. But that's a good observation. And there's something very biblical about the whole thing, right? Throughout like the Bible, there's many instances of common folk or people who you wouldn't expect being used as vessels for God's will. And this feels very much in keeping with that. I'm sure George R. R. Martin had that in mind when he was conceiving of these storylines.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't help but escape the biblical or note to the biblical sort of vibes coming off this whole thing. So yeah. Anyway,
plus Allison with her little like Jesus pose in the yeah. in the water this episode too.
Yeah, yeah.
Bible vibes.
Indeed. Okay. Anything else we want to say about these couple scenes? You know, there's this guy, the guy who is kind of a wet blanket on the whole.
Celtigar.
Celtigar. He looks like he's drunk this episode. Like he's literally holding yeah. a chalice and like. He's like, this plan sucks. It's never going to work. And, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know what's going on.
I don't think he's like, taking well to the slapping. Of
yeah.
Last,
he's clearly like losing it, I think. Right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. He seems to be understanding that he's in a lower standard here of all the other men on the small council.
Yeah.
And yeah, I also like seeing Jace's reaction to the news that, A, like the relief that Rhaenyra was okay, because obviously, like, you know, her just writing out last episode caused everyone a little bit of concern, because that's exactly what everyone's been telling her not to do, is like, don't go put yourself at risk. And they don't know who is on Sea Smoke. So like, God forbid it had been someone from Team Green and she was like going straight for a fight. But the way that his like relief turned to anger very quickly at the news that like, oh, it's some random guy, but he's going to be here as a guest and be like taught the art of dragon riding. At first I was like, huh, like why does Jace seem like pissed about that? And then I really like how that builds into the yeah. next few scenes.
Well, let's talk about it, right? Jace confronts Rhaenyra about the change of plan. He only wanted people from the formal houses of Westeros to try and claim the dragon, not mongrel bastards and lowborn small folk. He's angry at her for bringing silver-haired Targaryen bastards into the mix, resentful of the way he wound up looking like Sir Harwin Strong instead of a Targaryen or a Valyrian. I wanted to read this email to acastofkings@gmail.com. This one comes in from Matt, just writing on this topic. Quote, when Jace and Rhaenyra hatch, pun intended, the plan to look for long-forgotten descendants of the Targaryen Empire to become dragon riders, they do so in the most trickle-down economics way ever. They scour the ancient scrolls to find somebody who generations ago had some connection to a dragon rider bloodline. It's so far-fetched that when Rhaenyra announces the idea to the ill-fated Sir Darklyn, she noted that his grandmother's grandmother, Arianna, was born a Targaryen princess. Okay, so a woman four generations removed from Sir Darklyn was born a Targaryen. That makes Sir Darklyn about 6% Targaryen, hardly enough to feel Sea Smoke. Rather than look for legitimate but decidedly distant relatives in the ancient scrolls, Sea Smoke seeks out and corners Adam, who is Corlys's son and 50% Valyrian. Jace and Rhaenyra have been so focused on royal blood, they seem to have overlooked the much stronger bloodline that exists in a living bastard. Once again, the highborns just forget the small folk. I couldn't help but be reminded of Jon Snow's journey in Game of Thrones. And with the screen time Ulf has received in recent episodes, one can't help but think it may not be the last time. Thanks for the amazing work and everything you do to make watching Season 2 of House of Dragon more enjoyable and comprehensible, end quote. That comes from Matt, writing into castofkings@gmail.com.
Nailed
I assume
it.
Matt is a show watcher and not a book reader, but yes, that's he, assuming Matt didn't know, you yeah. called it, Matt.
Yeah.
And if you did know, then I don't know why you wrote that email. But some people, there is this thing in Game of Thrones where like, this
people
is a
would pretend
thing.
To not
yeah,
know.
People would pretend to not know. And then they would go on the Reddit boards and be like, I predict that blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, because you read the book. And it's like, okay,
yeah.
Some people need to get their jolly somehow. I'm not saying Matt's that person. I'm just saying,
yeah,
you know. He called it. This is in fact the main conflict is between the highborn and the lowborn and the small folk and so on. Like, and I appreciate that the show emphasizes how transgressive it is, that they're even considering this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right. And it is also interesting because it does differ from the book in the sense that in the book, we're only told that like, this was Jace's, that all of like this sowing of the seeds, the dragon seeds, was Jace's idea. It's not mentioned that he had any issue.
And just to clarify, sowing the dragon seeds means, for those who don't know.
Right, so dragon seed is the term used to describe any Targaryen bastard, so like seed of the dragon.
I see.
Yeah. And then sowing those seeds, like if you're planting those seeds, you are creating more dragon riders.
Got it.
Is, I believe...
Got it.
Where all of that terminology is coming from.
Got it.
So yeah, like I do really appreciate that the show chose to add complexity to this decision. And it makes sense. Like, it makes more sense to me for Jace to have misgivings about putting lowborn folk on dragons versus highborns, specifically because of what he mentions of like, well, don't you think that my claim could now be at risk?
Right.
If A, I don't look like a typical Targaryen prince, and what used to be special about me, which was that I had a dragon, is now no longer special. And I think it's...
Like, let me have this, Mom. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me have this. What, you know, I couldn't have the golden hair, but at least I could have the dragon rider, and you're going to take that away from me too.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
And I think it does almost the decision to test whether or not Targaryen royalty basically can be dragon riders. The idea to test that, I think, has maybe similarities or like parallels to Team Green's decision / Christian Cole's decision to parade Melisse's head through the small folk, which is basically taking these creatures who were thought to be gods, right? Like thought to be greater than any other living entity known to the world. And the fact that Targaryens seem to have like a special connection with it, it sort of like lowers, like it removes that mystique a little bit of like, oh, so you're saying that this whole time any rando from a bar in King's Landing could have gone and claimed a dragon. You just didn't give us the opportunity until now, is different than, oh, the reason why you House Targaryen have been ruling Westeros is because you are special and like transcendent in this way. Yeah.
There is one brief scene, by the way, of Corlys talking to Allen and saying Rhaenyra needs ships to go to King's Landing and carry a message. And Corlys tells him about Adam riding Sea Smoke, implying he could try to be a dragon rider too. And they talk about the two men's mother and how she must have been the one with dragon rider blood. And Adam implies he has no desire to claim a dragon the way his brother did. So, the show has tried its best to kind of introduce these characters and make them relevant. And I think the show this season just really was very ambitious in terms of how many characters it wanted to include. Mm. And I think the Adam and Alan stuff for me as just a show watcher didn't make a big impression. Cause I'm like, you have these two extremely talented actors and they're in like six scenes the whole season, and I'm just like, it's hard for me to really invest in what's going on there. Even if though one of them is riding Sea Smoke, I'm like, that's super cool, but like I barely know anything about this guy, mm-hmm. So anyway, just some quick reflections on that. And it's also at this moment still unclear to me why they need to be two separate characters. So like I'm sure we'll find out at some point like what the deal is there. I guess this scene kind of shows, one guy's still doing the ship stuff and the other guy's doing the dragon stuff. Okay, fine. But like They could have easily written around that, so I'm kind of curious like what they're doing there. But anyway, any other thoughts on the Adam Allen stuff this episode, Kim?
I really liked seeing Adam get to be. It's like watching, it reminds me of like Disney movies of like, a little girl realizing that she's a princess all of a sudden, kind of like vibes of being like, oh, like I have like a fancy room now, and like he gets new clothes and gets to like walk alongside Bela and like kind of like stand in this like position of esteem. And I did think that I thought that that was cool. And you do get the sense that like he's just stoked to be here, right? Like he did not expect that he would be a dragon rider, let alone like go from, being a lowborn bastard who assumed he would never be acknowledged in any meaningful way, shape, or form to being, one of the most important people in Queen Rhaenyra's retinue all of a sudden. So.
Well, anyway, Adam and Elinda help get the message around King's Landing that Rhaenyra wants any Targaryen bastard to come to Dragonstone. Ulf and Hugh are among the men and women who take up the call and head to meet their queen and the dragons. So we see how the mistress or master of whispers does their work. Like, literally, it's a little bit comical. Like, you see her literally going up to people and whispering to them. But what is, you know, it's a little clunky there, but what is cool about it is you do see, like, a variety of settings and sets and, like, locations. And so, like, it really does make King's Landing feel like a real place. And that's that's something that this sequence does really well. So,
yeah.
There's also, like, people suspiciously observing them being whispered to. And I wondered if those were, like, Laris's people. Do you know what I'm saying? You see that, like, when, like, this woman... Also, let me just put this out there. If you are going to be making whispering your whole job, consider wearing a less conspicuous outfit.
You mean not a bright red?
Not bright red. Not like, oh, I can easily...
Team Rhaenyra. Team Rhaenyra. Yeah.
It's literally like, if that person walks through a crowd, you can easily identify that person. Yeah. You know? It's like... you gotta be a little bit more conspicuous. That is the thing, that it's more for the viewer at home than it is like the authenticity of what someone in that situation would actually do. Because you're watching at home, oh, I can easily identify that person. In real life, it would be, oh, that's Missaria's lieutenant, you know, and let's kill her immediately. You know, like that's so anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So Kim, I mean, we're really getting to it, which is, why have we been following the adventures of Ulf and Hugh this whole season? Right. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, and we are getting the answer.
Yeah.
This episode.
Yeah.
And there is like this scene with, I think, Hugh and his wife, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, he reveals to his wife that his mother is a Targaryen. The sister of Baelon and aunt to Viserys and Daemon. The idea is that like Hugh Hammer's mother was one of
King Jaehaerys's children. So, and King Jaehaerys was Viserys's grandfather and the king before Viserys. He was the one who like basically wound up accidentally having no clear heir, and they took a vote to see if it would be Viserys or Rhaenys. So Sarah, I believe they don't say her name, but it seems to me like what Hugh is revealing here is that his mother was Sarah Targaryen. Of course, there's an extra E in there because George R. Martin can't have normal names spelled normally.
Is Sarah identified as Hugh's mother in the books, or is that just your speculation?
No, that's just my speculation.
Oh, gotcha.
It seems to be what they're going with.
But the idea is that one of King Jaehaerys's daughters became a sex worker.
Yes, which that is in Fire and Blood.
Right, and then that sex worker
was
already a Targaryen? Like, didn't need to sleep with a Targaryen to make another Targaryen, right?
No, so like all of her children were automatically 50% Targaryen. Yeah. So Hugh is... what the show is doing is implying that he was one of her bastards and that he knew that, but that it was like, it was a secret and that he was ashamed of this the whole time. But that like, again, kind of like speaking about like the question and exactly to the point of like Matt's email, the idea that like a Targaryen bastard who's been of a recent generation has a far stronger like blood claim to House Targaryen than someone many, many generations before. So like Hugh and Ulf are basically full half Targaryen in a way.
Is Ulf Hugh's brother, right? Is that the...
No.
Yeah. Different
dad. Ulf, I believe, claims that his... Oh, gosh. I need to go back and check my notes.
Is this explained in the show? Like, is Ulf's lineage...
In the books?
Is Ulf's lineage... Because like Hugh has this whole scene where he says who his mother is and it's very shocking. And I don't think Ulf gets a similar scene, right?
He did in his first introduction.
I see. Okay.
Which I can look up. I might have written down his quote.
It's explained somewhere. That's fine.
But that was like his introduction was in a bar where he was bragging about the fact that he was part Targaryen. And he like... He specifically says like that, you know, he's back in Queen Rhaenyra, and that's right when Aegon walks into the bar with his friends and they're like, drinks on us. That was like Ulf's introduction.
According to Kim Renfro's excellent notes, Ulf claims to be the bastard son of Balon, who is Viserys' brother, which makes him Rhaenyra's uncle.
Oh, so it does make him, it makes him Hugh's cousin.
There you go.
They're cousins.
There you go. There you go. I trust what you're saying because I have
And
no
cousin
idea.
To Viserys and Daemon. So like Hugh, Ulf, Viserys, and Daemon were all of the same generation of children of Jaehaerys' children.
Yeah. And the way to keep that all straight is Hugh is the one with the beard. That's that's how I put it together. The show Hugh's the one with the beard. Okay, yeah. So, you know, I think Kim Renfro, the show runners, knew we had to get to this point of Hugh and Ulf riding these dragons, and so. Mm-hmm. They wanted to back out from that. They wanted to back out from that of like the penultimate episode of House of the Dragon is going to culminate with Hugh and Ulf riding these dragons. So backing out from that, how do we make people give a shit about Hugh and Ulf? So they're like, okay, we got to introduce them earlier in the season. We're going to give Hugh this tragic backstory where his daughter is sick and they don't have enough food and they really need to get out of this situation. And so my question for you, Kim, is did it work for you?
I thought it was fine.
Yeah, that's exactly my reaction is it was fine. It's not terrible, but it wasn't like, oh, I need to see what happens to Hugh next week, right?
No, and I'm trying to think now if I do think I prefer having spent a bit of time with both of them before they claimed a dragon, as opposed to them just
like, what if they just showed up this episode? Like, that's the alternate history. It's like, what if they just showed up this episode?
Yeah.
And you just meet these characters for the first time. And it's like,
That would have
required
a lot more legwork of, like, us caring about them in the moment as being, like, the two who...
Right.
Who stand out from this group of, you know, 50 or however many random Targaryen bastards. So, yeah. I think I liked Hugh's... I liked the time that we spent with Hugh a little bit more maybe than Ulf, but...
Is Hugh the one that steals the food from that poor person in the street? Yeah.
Yeah. So, very desperate. You know, it's funny because I had clocked, like, you know, he was carrying his daughter to the gates in that scene right after Aemond had, like, ordered the gates shut. They were trying to escape. And I remember thinking in that moment, I was like, she looks pretty unconscious and, like, gray skinned. I was sort of like, is he holding his daughter's dead body? And I think that now the implication was yes, that like his daughter literally like died in his arms during their attempt to flee the city.
Oh man.
Which is really sad. And
because I don't think we see her this episode, right? So
no, and he just says like I couldn't save our daughter. Like the implication being now that she has died and that it's just the two of them now. And his wife is like, well, cool. I just lost my daughter and I don't want to become a widow now, which the odds of that happening seemed very high.
Statistically, like, I think it's something like 95% or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah.
I also thought it was fine. Like it's, how satisfying would it have been if they just showed up this episode and you had to like learn who these, it's like, is it satisfying if it's just two random dudes?
Right.
That's like, you know, and it's like, okay, I understand why they had to do it that way. And also, they probably did it about as good as you could have done it. You know, like, it's hard to imagine how they could have done it better than this. Maybe they could have dedicated more time. But when I was watching those scenes, I was like, why do I care about any of it? Like, why do I care about these people who are not connected to this other thing? You know, like,
It's hard.
It's a hard task to, like, make you care about these characters who, like, don't really seem to have any connection with them until it finally pays off this episode, right. Anyway, show for trying to make us care about Hugh and Ulf, we salute you. Anyway, let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more conversation about this episode right after this.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
All right. The dragon seeds arrive at Dragonstone, and Rhaenyra greets them in the library. Before she can get started on the plan for the dragon riding auditions, the dragon keepers confront her and say they'll take no part in having these non-Valyrian descendants try to claim a dragon after what happened to Sir Stefan Darklyn. And they walk off. They walk off. Rhaenyra then gives this very, very lengthy monologue. I mean, this is like 5 minutes plus, maybe, of like just straight up monologuing. Really well delivered, I thought. Mm-hmm. Really impassioned speech.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, though, in light of what comes afterwards, it's a little comical, just this monologue. But I can go into that more in a bit. Kim Renfro, what were your reactions to this sequence?
I found it, I was getting like cult leader vibes from it.
Yeah.
Which ties into what I was saying earlier about like this episode for me kind of marking a shift in how I feel about Rhaenyra's. I feel like up until this point, the show, it almost has been going out of its way to bolster the idea that all the decisions that Rhaenyra is making are kind of like the right ones, or like are done with all of the best possible intentions that a character within this setting might have for the most part. And this was when I was like, oh, I think she's starting to lose her grip a bit on if she's coming from like a morally righteous place or not, or like the way that she seems to be leaning into speaking of the gods kind of having control over the situation as opposed to herself, I thought was significant. And then yeah, like the fact that she has this convert, like the way that she's like moving around the room and she like tells her Kingsguard, you know, like, oh, like don't follow me, like it just felt to me like this sort of like culty, like,
yeah,
I like, yes, like I'm not only your queen, but like we are all like, you know,
this we're all connected.
We're this community of like shared blood, and like the gods will only decide like which one of us is worthy, and like very different, right, to the conversation that she had with Stefan, being like, I'm not compelling you to do this. I hope you know that it's so dangerous. Like, she seemed very emotional about the fact that she was putting his life at stake. Whereas this was like, may the gods be in your favor. and specifically her saying like, you know, what we're doing here is ending suffering without bloodshed. And I'm like, except all the people in this room, right? Like, you're telling these people who are most likely about to die that like you're doing this so that more people don't die. But she seems to have fully accepted that like that is a reasonable price to pay, right? Whereas before it felt like she really was taking every individual life being lost in this conflict with like a heaviness. And I think that it's significant.
Yeah, I think, you know, now that you kind of bring up this whole cult leader idea, that does make the episode make a lot more sense to me, because watching it, she gives this huge, impassioned, grandiose speech about, we're here to end suffering. That's what I want to do as your president.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, and you know, the only way I can be your president is if one of you can get on one of these freaking things.
Mm-hmm.
And as president, I will end starvation, you know. Yeah. I alone can fix it.
Yeah.
And then she just kind of throws them all into the dragon pit, and like, no instructions.
No, not no. even like a vocab lesson in like, here are the words that you should speak to try to calm them in Valyrian. Like,
but like, not even like, let me just put it this way. I don't think all those people had to die. I'm just gonna put this out there. Like,
yeah.
Like, she could have done them one by one. Like, hey, we're gonna send you out one by one into the dragon pit, and you might die.
Yeah.
But like, you know, at least the dragon won't get mad and torch 30 of you at once.
Right. And her soldiers, like some of her soldiers got torched for just standing there. Yeah. And kind of like low-key blocking the people from running away.
That was upsetting. Was it? You know, she must have given them instructions like, if they try to run away, you know, and like that's the thing that's most upsetting is like these people did not. I don't think these people like fully consented to exactly what was going to happen, right? Like,
yeah,
because she didn't like. Maybe there is a scene that was cut where she like explains, okay, here's the deal, we're all going to go in there and blah.
No,
but like if that didn't happen, then these people didn't really like fully consent to what was going on. I mean, I guess maybe. You know, the terms of the agreement were you're either going to ride a dragon or you're going to die. Like,
right.
Because what is she going to do? Like, return them back to King's Landing where they can tell everyone about this whole secret mission? You know, like, so yeah. maybe, but like, we don't really see any of that. Like, we just have to kind of sort of imagine that she was fair to these people. But from what we see, it seems like she treated them horribly. You know, that's kind of, so...
Yeah, no, I think that that is what happened. And that's why I think that this is kind of marking a shift in her approach to this war and not for the better. You know?
All right. So let's get to it. Rhaenyra summons Vermithor and she leaves the group of 50 or so people to try and tame him. I got to just say, this. Every shot of this sequence is excellent, right? Mm-hmm. Vermithor showing up behind, like the way they've lit the cave so that Vermithor, you see Vermithor's wing before you see Vermithor's face and head, and you see Rhaenyra touching the dragon, and it reminded me of like watching like Dune 2, where you can sense the scale of what a human is compared to all this massive stuff around them. Rhaenyra touching Vermithor, indicating, hey, see, the dragon can be tamed. So, like, which of you will be the one to... And by the way, no system. I was thinking there'd be some kind of lottery thing of, like, okay, we're pulling names out of a hat now. Nope, it's just...
Nope. Which one of you wants to walk forward?
Whoever's raising their hand first. And by the way, all of you might die.
None of you have probably ever heard High Valyrian spoken, let alone tried to speak it. So, like, good luck to you trying to guess what to say to the dragon. And like, you know, she is saying words like serve and like calm all the things that we know the dragons, all of these terms that the dragons seem to know and will recognize from like a competent dragon rider, and they will listen. She doesn't even attempt to give them any instruction in what to say or do. So, yeah.
Even gnarly. Just from a purely self-interested standpoint, like if I'm
right, you don't want to give them the best odds,
right? And I'm like, I want to find a dragon. Or like, there's stuff you could do to like improve their chances. But she just is like, nope, just throw them in there and make sure they don't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the massive dragon starts wreaking havoc, burning and eating most of the people set before him. Ulf escapes the blaze and runs further into the caverns, but Hugh steps up to save a woman, getting Vermithor's attention and eventually claiming the Bronze Fury. The whole Hugh scene is really well done. First of all, it's cool that you're seeing, like, when you see a dragon cave, like Vermithor's cave, it's kind of like when you're watching Star Wars, in my opinion, where they build these massive, like, catwalks. And then underneath, there's like a 100-story fall. And I'm always like, what's at the bottom of those things?
Yeah.
And here you see, like, what's at the bottom of that thing, that walkway that they're on? And you see people fall down and they're at the bottom of the walkway and it looks like visually consistent. They do the entire Hugh stuff. It's done up to look like it's one continuous shot. And so it's really intense, very like a horror, like a monster movie, basically, like done really well. Like a genre film, basically.
Reminded me of like a T-Rex Jurassic Park kind of scene. And
then the moment when Hugh gets control, he's like, oh, you not only need to have Targaryen blood, you also need to have a Targaryen heart. That was my conclusion, which is then immediately undermined by the next scene where Ulf like tames dragon. But anyway, it was an incredible scene where Hugh stands up to the dragon and is able to bring him to heel.
Yeah.
And just incredible stuff. Kim, any reactions from you about this?
Yeah, I agree that it was so incredible. I also really loved seeing, you know, what it took. Like, Hugh looked fearful, as it makes sense for anyone to do, especially like earlier, like when Vermithor first shows up, but like the fact that his moment came when he decided to try and help save someone else, which like we don't really, that was like the only, I think, instance in the chaos that we really saw like two people trying to help each other.
Right. Altruism. Yeah.
Exactly. Instead of like, oh, I'm going to shove you like closer to the fire or whatever.
Yeah.
And the fact that he like the way that he says like, I'm ready. And I feel like in that moment, like maybe he doesn't even know if he's saying like, I'm ready to die or I'm ready to be claimed. Like both, I think, are might be equally true for him in that moment of like everyone else seems to be running away from what's happening and trying not to die. And he seems to accept the fact that like, I'm ready to either be eaten by you or I'm ready to like step up and take my moment. And I think that that does, exactly to your point, seem like a thing that a dragon can recognize in a person of like that you have the heart. I also just loved his like bro yell of like, come on. Like it, I felt like I was like watching like a guy in like a football stadium, like cheering on or like, you know, aggressively rooting for something like, and yeah. Right. Like the contrast between that approach versus like, oh, I'm speaking, you know, High Valyrian in like this very like specific, specific tilt to my intonations, or like I'm not singing a lullaby to him, I'm just yelling like, come on. And then Vermithor is like, all right, like no one's tried that one before, I like you, bro. Right.
Yeah, he does save that woman, like this woman kind of gets away and Vermithor is about to eat her or something, and then he distracts Vermithor and saves her.
He says like, here I am, which again is like both like I'm here as bait, but it's also like I'm your rider over here, sir. Like,
yeah.
The Uber pulled up to the wrong passenger.
Yeah. So I will say it was kind of disappointing to me the next scene where Ulf right like gets on the drink.
Yeah.
I was thinking like as a viewer, I was thinking, oh, I finally figured it out. Like I figured it's because like
what it takes.
Stefan Darklyn and these other people, they didn't have the heart. They didn't have the courage to do this, you know? And then when Hugh Hammer is able to subjugate Vermithor, I'm like, oh, I get it now. I get it. And then the next scene, I'm like, I don't get it.
I've lost it.
I've lost it. Ulf stumbles upon Silverwing during her nap, stepping on her laid eggs in the process. Somehow, Silverwing decides Ulf is a rider, and the next thing we know, he's flying over King's Landing. So,
yeah.
Kim, make it make sense.
Make I don't know that sense. I can. All the dragon riding lore feels very opaque and by design by George R. R. Martin at this point. And it's interesting that maybe the show writers are also like, seems to be a multitude of ways in which this might function. And so,
right, so maybe different dragons have different criteria.
Yeah, like the dragons have personality too.
Right.
And it maybe is worth noting that Silverwing is mentioned in Fire and Blood to be known as being quote docile compared to the other dragons. So like if Vermithor is the aggressive one who needs someone who's very bold to like also be his rider, like Silverwing, it seems like the only credit I will give to Ulf is that he stopped trying to run away, that like he seemed to like accept his fate of like, all right, I'm about to die and like I'm just gonna close my eyes and like lay here. And that, like, maybe just that was enough for Silverwing to be like, oh, like, you know, you're not trying to run away from me. You're also not trying to, like, you don't have hubris in, like, the way that maybe Stefan Darklyn did.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, yeah, maybe just her demeanor is that she's more chill. And I'm referring to Silverwing as a her because, like, yeah, she seems to have laid eggs. And I think that that's, like, that's one of the few ways that people know what the sex of a dragon is if they are actively laying eggs or not. And so, yeah, I also, aside from the mysterious way in which Ulf seems to have won Silverwing, I just loved the staging of the shot though. Like I spotted her right away, like up against the wall, but I don't know if you did, like the way that she was sort of camouflaged in her sleeping position, I thought was very cool of being like, oh, like, you know, you kind of got the anticipation of being like, he doesn't realize that he has just stepped into a new, like a different dragon's nest. Also the like liquid that he falls into, that's like, doesn't seem like water. I was like, is that like dragon pee? Is that what it looked like?
He had like stepped on an egg, right?
He stepped on it, stepped like in, it's almost like the way that dragons lay eggs. It seems to be like that there's eggs and then there's like a film, mm-hmm. like a sort of like dome coating them. So right, he steps in that. But then when he like falls back, he falls into sort of like a puddle of liquid that looks like black and kind of like it doesn't look like water to me. Yeah. And I was like, is that dragon pee? Because he steps earlier through what I assume is like dragon manure, basically. So I was like, this is a gnarly, again, like seeing what the ground floor of a dragon nest would actually look like, I think was a fun detail of this episode.
All right, so the different dragons have different personalities and different criteria for how you can tame them.
Yeah, which I guess adds to the chaos of trying to find a rider for them.
Right. Well, we've already seen Sea Smoke. We've already seen Sea Smoke like just go straight up find someone, right? So
yeah.
I guess it does then therefore follow that okay, the different dragons would have different ways of finding people.
Yeah.
But I
agree that it was a little anticlimactic after.
Right.
And like, and the fact
because it's so badass, it was so badass. Like, it was the Hugh Hammer stuff is so badass, right? Like,
yeah. And Ulf, especially because like Ulf, like earlier in the episode too, was like already being kind of trying to get out of the summons, mm-hmm. basically. Like, you know, mm-hmm. that he had been all bark and no bite. Right. Like, I don't feel like we really saw him fully turn around from that in a way that I thought we would. And then we don't see any of them, including Adam. We have not yet seen any of these guys go from the claiming point to actually like climbing on the dragon and riding him. So yeah, I was a little bit like, oh, like we just jumped straight from like Silverwing kind of like settling back down and being like, I'm not going to eat you, to then like, oh, next thing we know, he's flying over King's Landing. And it's like, how did that happen? And like,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Final scene. So Ulf is riding Silverwing over King's Landing, and as a result, Aemond sees it during a small council meeting, and he runs to Vhagar, chases Silverwing back to Dragonstone, but there he notices, hey, there's three dragons there waiting for him, and he's not ready to fight three dragons right now. So he turns around and flees back to King's Landing, and the episode ends with Rhaenyra standing on the shores of Dragonstone looking defiant towards mm-hmm. Aemond. End of the episode. Really effective ending, in my opinion. Pretty badass stuff. Kim, any closing thoughts on this episode of the show?
I will admit, the first time I watched this, feeling a little confused as to like why Aemond had decided to turn around. And then I realized maybe I just have poor eyesight than Aemond on Dragonback does, but then it was like when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, it's that she made it very obvious that she has more dragons. And I'm guessing, I also like wasn't sure. I was like, did Hugh just like go, or not Hugh, did Ulf go kind of rogue?
Right, like
did
Rhaenyra send Ulf to, you know, like, because it looks like Ulf doesn't even know what the hell he's doing.
Right.
But that was my question, was like, is this a plan for Rhaenyra to let Aemond know that she has three dragons? But then it's like, why would she want that? That's a thing that you're giving up the element of surprise, you know? Mm. But I had the same reaction as you, because the way it's filmed, you see Aemond heading towards Dragonstone, pursuing one dragon.
Yeah.
And then Aemond seems to have a realization.
Yeah.
And then he says, all right, Vhagar, turn around. And you as a viewer don't know why he says that until the next scene where Rhaenyra shows up on shore with three dragons. And actually, I believe there's currently four or five dragons they have, right? Like, it's Vermithor, Sea Smoke, Silverwing, Rhaenyra's dragon, and also Jace's dragon, theoretically, right?
And Bela's Moon Dancer.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
Cyrax and Vermax. Yeah. Yeah. So she has six.
Right, but only five theoretically on Dragonstone, right?
No. I think all six are there.
All six are there. Okay.
Because we saw Bela in the episode too. So presumably Moon Dancer is there.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
Plus they know that she has Daemon and theoretically, right. Damon and Caraxes. So she's now got her total up to 7.
So we only see half of the dragons that Rhaenyra has access to at the end of this episode, right?
Yeah. So I think that you're right that maybe, like, I upon my second watch, I decided that it did seem like it must have been her intention to, like, goad. I think that maybe it wasn't so much that she was simply just trying to, like, reveal that she had the dragons. Maybe she was hoping that Aemond would fully take the bait and that they would be able to end Aemond and Vhagar right then and there. But either way, like, she has now made it known that Team Black just, like, severely upped their dragon rider count in a way that tips the balances of the war.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess her goal is to end the war. So, like, maybe maybe she would want them to know about it. But either way, it's not super clear, like, exactly how intentional the whole Ulf thing was. Would she really send this new guy into King's Landing to do this mission? You know, like, it's...
Yeah.
I think Ulf was just cruising around. That's my right. take on it.
And, like, I felt like he would, like, it was almost like he wanted to, like, show off to his buddies who were, like, you know, like, hey, I did do it, you know, like, I've been bragging my whole life about how, like, I could be a dragon rider if I wanted to, and, like, here I am. But
That's cool. Anyway. All right. Great episode. Great episode of the show. So, again, looking forward to / apprehensive of how they're going to wrap this all up next episode or not, you know? But we will be here talking about it, covering it right here on A Cast of Kings. I do want to just remind people, next episode will come out a little bit later than usual, just because we're going to be recording it live the night of the airing of the finale, because we will not have screeners. And then we'll follow that the following week with kind of a postmortem, thinking through what happened this season, picking up things we didn't catch for the finale viewing. And we'd love your emails and messages at acastofkings@gmail.com. Until then, she is Kim Renfro. I'm David Chen. You're listening to A Cast of Kings Decoding TV podcast. We'll see you next week.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.